Hi everyone, welcome to North and South Podcast. This is Tim speaking. This is in association with Hope Street, this podcast. And one of the key reasons why is that the gentleman I'm speaking to, Paul Cope, I first heard him speak at a Hope Street meeting in 2021. I was very impressed and I've since gone on to read his fantastic book, How to Solve Any Problem in Life, which is a bold statement, but we'll come to that later. I've also done his online course, which I think equates, Paul, to about 24 hours worth of material that you're meant to do over 3 days, but I did it over a few months, which was fantastic. And I've also listened to about 3/4 of your podcasts. I'm slowly working my way through them. So, Paul, you're an ex-lawyer and a life coach, and you believe in a holistic approach to living a better life by analysing the past and showing wisdom in the present. I know you were happy with me describing you that way. And I found your book, your course and your podcast, I find them really user-friendly, and you're probably the biggest single influence on me so far in terms of making me better. I've got issues in my life, and I think that I'm just so happy that I've been exposed to your work and heard about you and being able to delve deep into it. So I just want to thank you. I was a bit starstruck when you first appeared on the screen. So I'm going to stop talking now, Paul, and over to you. How would you describe your approach to life and how did you arrive there?
Well, firstly, thank you for saying all those nice things. I don't think anyone ever gets used to that stuff being said to them. So yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it and I'm glad it's helped. How did I get to where I am? Well, I'm 42 now. So there's a long answer to that question, but the short answer is, I guess I've always been, since I was a little kid, I've always been I heard someone use this word the other day and I liked it, contrarian. Like, I've always challenged stuff. And I know most kids do challenge stuff, but I was always the kid where, if I asked why was something done the way it was done and you said it's always been done like that, that was the worst thing you could say to me. My dad left me in his car once. I don't have that many childhood memories, but this is one I do have. He left me in his car once while he just went to the shops. And when he came back, I'd taken his dashboard apart of the car. Because I just remember those old, even now people like, you cigarette lighters in a car. But remember, you used to have cigarette lighters, yeah. And I pressed it. And when it popped out, it like a wire came out with it. So I just started following the wire. By the time my dad got back, I was just sitting there and like the whole dashboard had come apart. And so I've just always been the person who could challenge things, question things. And then I actually ended up going down quite a mainstream path through education and stuff, became a lawyer. And then it was through the back of that just very much started questioning stuff. And the turning point in my adult life was depression, basically. Got to the point in my mid-30s where, on paper, if you'd have known me back then, or people who did know me, or if you write down what I had, it's everything the world tells us we should have in order to be happy. I was a successful lawyer. I had my own law firm. I'd worked for some of the biggest law firms on the planet, spent my life trying to be a lawyer, set up my own law firm, which was successful. Lived in a big city centre apartment, owned 5 houses, drove a flash car, had money. And so on the surface was everything people would want. And behind the scenes, I was depressed. I was suicidal. It was just like, there's got to be more to life than this. And that's when that sort of old thing kicked back in again of like, well, I'm not just going to settle for this then. I'm going to try and figure it out. And that's what started me on the path I'm on now, which was, I was dealing with loads of things in my life. Loads of high level symptoms. So I was depressed, but I also had chronic health issues. My relationship with my wife was awful. I had money problems, even though I was always boom and bust with money. I would make loads of money, but then I could never keep it and it would always go. Just problems right across my life. And I just started dealing with different things. And the other side of me is this is where my life has sort of come together in different ways. I've always been the person looking to solve problems. And even as a lawyer, when clients would bring problems to me, most lawyers will just deal with the problem that's presented to them. But I would always be like, no, well, how can we get to the bottom of this? What's the thing that's causing this problem? I used to have my best clients used to create issues all the time. And to most lawyers, that's like, they're made up because they just get ongoing work forever. And I used to say to them, no, I don't want you to keep getting in these situations. How can we solve the root of the problem so you don't get in these situations all the time, which isn't good for me as your lawyer because I'll earn less money, but it's better for you, which is what I'm meant to be doing. And what I realized was, as a lawyer, people don't want to hear that really. And loads of different things came together then for me to come down this path and really get to the root of stuff, which was, you know, looking at the psychology, looking at emotions, looking at what's really going on behind the scenes in all of our lives.
Yeah, and I think that deep level of analysis, I think, you know, constantly asking why, I think that shines through in all your work, that there's deeper reasons why these things are happening. And you often speak, you don't dismiss the self-help world, the idea that, like, you know, you can wake up and say, right, I'm going to have a good day and just say that and everything's great. And there is a lot of utility in those kind of things to a degree. But with you, it's very much about cut and branch, looking at the deep aspects of what makes a person. So what you say is that you need to look at the past, and self-help isn't enough because that's looking at a fairly superficial level and you really need to go deep. And how would you say, what kind of things influenced you in the pursuit of that, and how complex did that make the mission, if you like?
Well, the big thing about me with sort of the traditional personal development and self-help world is that I'm pretty much like gamekeeper turned poacher. Like I used to love the traditional personal development world. I started getting interested in all that stuff when I was in my mid-20s. And I'd already broken sort of traditional barriers by, I was 3 years qualified when I left the mainstream legal world and set up my own law firm when I was 29. At the time, people were saying to me I was crazy to do that. I look back at photos now and I look like I was about 12 years old. But that was, I was reading stuff then about how you can make your life better and different ways of doing things, and that all resonated with me. My issue with that traditional world is what you pretty much said, which is it's only surface level most of the time. And there are parts of it that are still helpful. But I've reached a point where I think actually a lot of it is more damaging than it is helpful because of what I've discovered through the work I've done. And where I got to was I probably spent 15, 20 years building my life around that traditional personal development and self-help world, and realized that that was still contributing to me being depressed. And it was helping me, for example, build a business and make money and buy houses. But that wasn't solving the problem deep inside my soul, which was I was unfulfilled and I was empty and I just kept doing these things. And when I look at that, the sort of personal development world especially, and the financial side of that, and even things like the fitness side, what I see a lot of are remnants of what I've discovered with where I've gone now, which is the root cause of everything, to sum it all up for me, is low self-esteem, low self-worth, what we think about ourselves deep inside. The problem with the personal development world is most of it is built on that premise without knowing it. It's built on, we already feel like we're not good enough, and the way we will feel better is if we get more. So if we make more money, or if we get fitter, or if we sleep with more women, or if we marry a better husband, or we buy a new car, and loads of the personal development world will help you do all of that. But what it, I don't think it does it intentionally. Mm. And I think most things in life are well-intentioned, but what it doesn't account for is actually what you're just building on top of this low self-worth. And the problem with that is no matter how much you get, you will never feel fulfilled. You will never feel good enough, because the external stuff just isn't enough. And that's where this just led me to dig deeper, basically, to be like, well, that stuff just isn't working. I've done loads of that. And loads of people who come to me have done the same. Like, I've done all this stuff, Paul, and I'm still not happy. So what do I do next? And I'm like, oh, it's this alternative way, which is it's deeper. It's going inside yourself, not to the external world. And it's all, I mean, none of this stuff is new. My take on it is, Joe, probably a modern interpretation and bringing lots and lots of different aspects of the world together to try and make it simple for people to understand. But loads of this stuff goes back thousands of years, and it's almost the modern world has forgotten it in part, and because we're so distracted now with bright, shiny things in the external world that we've forgotten sort of this ancient wisdom of it's inside us that is in the most important place. And this, I mean, you can go really deep with this. This is in like spiritual and religious texts. This is basically what the Bible says. And I'm not a religious person. I am very spiritual these days, but I wouldn't class myself as religious, even though I was raised a Catholic. And But when the older I've got, the more I read like snippets of religious texts, and that's what these things are saying. Like the kingdom of heaven is inside us, is said in the Bible. That basically is what this is about. Like the kingdom of heaven isn't a place we go to, like after we die. It's a place inside us where we can find it ourselves, and that's what we're getting very deep and spiritual very early. But, that's what this is all about, really. Which is, if you can do that work, if you can face yourself and you go deep inside you and figure all this stuff out, actually the external stuff doesn't matter anymore, and then you don't need this traditional personal development world, and there are still bits of it that you can plug in that will help.
I think you said in the past that 50% of what you kind of put forward as your holistic approach to life you've picked up from others, and 50% of it is kind of things you worked out, but you've got it into a coherent whole where you're looking at not just the present but looking at the past and the deep elements of the psyche. Now, one of the most interesting aspects of your philosophy, if you like, and your way, is the idea of multi-personalities. And this is something I've found incredibly useful, because when I first heard you refer to this, I was doing some counselling, and we were doing transactional analysis, where you look at the idea of the parent, the adult, and the child that exists within your psyche. And then around the same time, I heard you use your multi-personality approach, which you say you've heard from others, but you've gathered together and very much made your own. I found this unbelievably useful. How would you explain the multi-personality approach and the idea of the control deck and the mic to someone who is listening to this who isn't used to what you've put forward?
The short version is we've all been raised with this idea that there's just one of us. Like there's just Tim, there's just Paul. And that's fundamentally wrong and fundamentally causes loads of problems. So the way I encourage everyone to look at it now is, rather than think of yourself as one person, think of yourself as like a massive ship, like the Starship Enterprise or a big boat or a spaceship out in space. And think about, picture that like control deck on one of those ships that, you know, that's where everything's run from. It's the computers, it's the switches, it's the screens, and it's got a team of people in there. And picture that inside your head. That's what's going on inside us. Like that's what's running us basically. And there's loads behind this and there's loads of different elements to it. But basically from the moment we're born, that control deck exists in order to keep us alive and to meet our emotional needs and practical needs in life, which is a separate and important conversation. But it's not there to make us happy. This is really important. It's not there to make us happy. It's there to keep us alive and to meet our needs. And what happens is from when we're a young child, the way the vast majority of us are raised is we're not cut out for the world in which we're born into. This is a very strange world that we live in, that humans were not built to live in. And what our control deck does is it creates adaptations. It creates new versions of us in order to cope with parts of the world that the real version of us can't deal with. So the way I look at it is, my interpretation of all of this is, and when people talk about the ego and personalities and archetypes and things, is that there's a real version of us, which is the true original little Tim, little Paul. That's the real version of us. And over time, this control deck inside our psyche creates new versions of us to help us deal with life. And over life, decades, what we end up with is a whole cast of characters. And the easy example I always give in my old life was what everybody in my old life would know me as, which was Copy, which was my nickname. And Copy was a very exuberant, outgoing, charismatic, extroverted, life and soul of the party personality. That is not who I am at heart. And most people who've ever met me question this. I've even got good mates from uni. The first time I told them about this, they were like, this is just nonsense. Like, that is who you are. And I was like, no, it's not. I'm actually, like, if you ask my family, I was a very shy, quiet little boy, very introverted. When I'm by myself, I love spending time by myself. It actually takes me a lot of energy to be extroverted and to be outgoing and to be around a lot of other people. But that was a character I developed in order to survive in a very loud family, in a very loud city, in a very extroverted world, where I needed a character that could do all of those things. So, you know, bounce into a pub and sing karaoke and dance and talk to lots of people. And that's the perfect example of that. Like my psyche, my control deck had created that character in order to help me survive in the world. And that was one of many. So the work I do with, a big part of the work I do with people is helping them to identify all of these different personalities we've created in our life and why we've created them. Because the twist in this, in that story, is why, even though we create them ourselves, a lot of those characters we end up not liking. They're a part of us that they meet our needs and they help us to survive, but we fundamentally don't like what they do in our life. And that's because they meet our needs and keep us alive by doing things in a subconscious and unhealthy way. And a huge part of the work I do is helping us to see those characters, why we've created them, and then help the true part of us to meet the same needs and to meet those survival needs in a way that is healthy and is conscious, instead of it all going on unhealthily and subconsciously, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and just obviously people watching and listening to this won't be able to see this, but I've actually got a little book where I wrote all my characters down. Now, you could read in a book, when you wake up in the morning, go past the mirror and say, yeah, I love you, you know what I mean? And you can kind of start doing that tomorrow, and it's fairly straightforward. But what you espouse and promote and encourage is this examination of the deep psychology of individuals. It takes work. And because it takes work, it's like peeling the layers off an onion. And I worked out I've got 7 sub-personalities, and I've narrowed it down to 5 because I literally use this practically day to day to say, right, who's on the mic, who's on the control deck? Because there's been times in my past, and I'm not just talking about when I'm drunk, where I think back to something and go, why did you do that? And I literally don't know why I did it, because it's like that person who did it is another person. And literally, when I read your work, I realised that it is actually another person who's connected to you, but is fairly independent of you. By saying to myself, right, who's on the mic here? If I'm feeling anxious or I'm a bit bothered about a family member who's speaking to me in a particular way, or someone's being a bit off with me, in the past, I would have let maybe the angry me or the low self-esteem me get on the mic. But now I can say, right, who's on the mic? Get the adult on the mic, the calm me, the Tim Short, and just make sure that person's in control. And one of the things you say as well is you're not trying to destroy these personalities and multi-personalities. You're saying to them, thanks for what you're doing. You're kind of sending a signal that I need to deal with this issue, but I'm going to make sure that the calmer, better, more healthy me is on the mic. And it's probably the most powerful thing I've ever heard. And, you know, I would encourage people to read your book and do your online course, because the breakthroughs I made doing this was phenomenal. So I did your online course, and then I read your book about a month after, and it kind of consolidated it. And now I'm listening to your podcasts, and it consolidates it even more. But it's probably the best day-to-day assistance I've ever had in terms of managing my day-to-day well-being, but by addressing the fundamentals rather than just trying to use like positive language. I'm actually examining the dark side of me, the unconscious, etc. And I can't say how powerful I found this stuff and how useful I found it. And again, though, if you'd have said this to me in my 20s, I'd have probably said, you know, whatever, I don't know what you're talking about, you know, that kind of thing. When you're a bit older and you've been through a few things, that kind of traumas in your life, you'd all of a sudden see that there's been different levels of you on the mic throughout your life for spells. And sometimes in a day, you can have like 7 different sub-personalities on the mic. That's how it works. But to understand it means you can then call it out and identify it, rather than just being a victim who just does whatever that personality wants at that time, whoever's on the mic. So I found it tremendously empowering. And I can't stress to people enough how much this has changed my life. So thanks to you for that.
You're welcome. And look, it's lovely to hear, and it's always really nice to hear when, because the whole reason I started doing this was because I'd done it in my life. I'd put all this stuff together from all different places, because again, that's something that I'm quite good at, is like absorbing information from different places and then explaining it. I used to do it as a lawyer. That something I don't like, the number of times I'll sit and read something that's really complicated and big long words, and I'm thinking, I'll be sitting sometimes reading something thinking, God, I've got a degree and I'm struggling to read this. Like, most people would just switch off from this altogether. And what's in it is useful, but it takes so much effort to try and get to it. And something I think just a skill of mine from years gone by is the ability to absorb stuff and then just sort of sum it up in a more easy to understand way. Because that's the way I like to do things. It's like, someone says something to me dead complicated, My brain likes to see things in very basic ways, and I like pictures and images and stories, and that's what most people like, I think. So what I found is that there was a gap for that, that I can take this stuff and explain it to people. So when I have someone saying to me, yes, it makes loads of sense, it really helps, because a lot of this stuff is based on, you mentioned earlier, I've taken this from lots of different places, but whenever anyone's talking about personalities, that tends to go back to the work of Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst from decades ago. And his stuff fits perfectly what I've just been saying. Like, I'm not sure I've ever finished one of his books for that heavy. And at the same time, he talks about archetypes, and even that word, you say archetypes to someone, like, I don't know what you're talking about, like, what you mean? But he's effectively talking about different aspects of our own personalities and psyches. And even then, like, what I tend to find is the sort of academic world likes to get very clever and highbrow about stuff, and that doesn't necessarily fit with our lives. So when I'm doing this work, I talk about, I rather than just go to set archetypes that the likes of Jung and other people like that have discovered over time and say exist, it's more about who are your personalities, who are my personalities, how do they show up in our real life? Because that's what matters here. Like, what are they actually doing in your life, and why do they exist? And going back to what you said before, like, I said something or I did something and I can't figure out why I did it. That's now that I've practiced this for so long, I've been doing this for years now in my own life, and then coaching people around the world. Someone can tell me something that they've done, and I can tell them in 10 seconds why they did it and what was going on subconsciously for them. It happened. I'll tell you a very quick story about this. I won't reveal who it was, actually. I always do that. I need to keep people's identities secret. So somebody I know was talking about one of their friends who's always in awful relationships, or like constantly getting involved in awful relationships. And this person said to me, I've told them they'll never get what they need from this relationship. And I just said to them gently, I couldn't disagree more. They're getting exactly what they need from this relationship. You're just not aware of what our needs are on a subconscious level. So quickly, for the person listening who won't know, I know you know this now, like, four core, there's loads of human needs, but four core ones for the purposes of this work: the need for certainty and control, the need for uncertainty and variety, the need for significance, and the need for love and connection. Well, if you're in a dysfunctional relationship, you are getting all of those needs met by that relationship. You're just doing it in an unhealthy way. Like, you can, this is, so the, when I first start working with people on this, a lot of people struggle with the concept, and then as soon as they get it, like, oh yeah. Like, if I say to someone, one of our needs is to feel special, is to feel significant. Most people associate the feeling of being special with something good. So it's like, well, this relationship doesn't make me feel good. I'm like, no, it doesn't make you feel good, but being special can also be a bad thing, because you feel significant every time you message all your mates and say, my boyfriend or girlfriend or husband or wife has been cruel to me again. And all your mates say to you, oh my God, you should leave them because you deserve better than this. Guess what? You get significance from that. You get everyone you know telling you how great you are. That makes you feel special. It just does it in a very unhealthy way. And when people start looking at it that way, all of a sudden, like, oh yeah. And all of a sudden, you get to see how the things you think you don't want in your life, you're doing yourself. Because this control deck, going back to what I said before, doesn't care about whether you're happy or not. That's not part of its job. If you want to be happy, that's a conscious thing. You need to change behaviors, and you need to, and that's what getting into this is all about. Really dig into it, figure out why you're doing the things you're doing, because they are meeting your needs and they are doing things you want at a subconscious level. What we want to do is bring that out into the light that we can do something about it.
Yeah, those four needs are brilliant. I think it was
Tony Robbins, I think they were
Tony
two of them.
Robbins. You said that you said that, and I mean, Tony Robbins is often thought of as a bit like a bit American, like, hey, let's change the world. But he doesn't all speak a lot of sense, and a lot of his courses I've listened to and stuff of his I've read, it's absolutely brilliant.
He's
But
a, well, look, he's a perfect example of Tony Robbins. Is someone I used to absolutely love
yeah.
20 years ago in the very mainstream personal development world. And I think he's evolved over time. And there is still a lot of his stuff that is worthwhile. And at the same time, you've read my book, my course, the big difference between using the word and but.
Yeah.
These things can all exist simultaneously. Tony Robbins, for me, still is part of the problem in that world of just pushing past too much stuff. Like, if you get up in the morning and you feel down, get in an ice bath and tell yourself you're great and put on some loud music and get on with your day. Now, there's room for that. But in the world I'm in, it's like, no. Sort out why you feel down first.
Yeah.
Allow that emotion to exist. Allow that part of you to be valid. Because going back to what you said before about telling yourself in the mirror you love yourself, what I realized was, look, that might work for some people. And I always say to everybody, whatever works for you, go with it. This is one of the things I don't like about people online is everyone's evangelical about the thing that they did that changed their life. But that was them. And that might not work for you. Like I even see it, whenever you see a study done or research or drug tests, the best you'll ever see is like 70, it worked for 70% of people. I'm like, and on a global level, that's great. But guess what? If it worked for 70% of people, it didn't work for 30% of people. And that means if you had 10 people in a room, three people it doesn't work for, well, you could easily be one of those three. So you've got to figure out what works for you and do that. So if, you know, if telling you, go for it, great. What I found is in my life and in a lot of people I've coached and everyone I've coached and most people I come across is it doesn't work for them. And it's because of this, because when you're telling yourself in the mirror that you love yourself, you're talking to the part of your character that you already like. So you talk, if you wrote down, you've found seven characters there, there'll be some of those you like and some of them you dislike. When you tell yourself you love yourself, you're not talking to the ones you don't like. And those ones are whispering to you from the darkness. Every time you say to yourself in the mirror, I love you, those ones whisper and they say, you don't love me. You don't like me at all. I'm a little terror in your life. And they're the most important part, because learning how to love them is where true development comes from. That's how you get to love yourself properly for who you are. That's how you build self-worth. And that's how you get to a point where the outside world doesn't bother you anymore.
I think that's very empowering. But I mean, doing your course and reading your book, you do lots of exercises which build this all up. You know, that, like, let's think about the good characters and the bad characters. What do they do? How are they meeting your needs? And it's good the way that you reveal it gradually and get deeper and deeper. Now, one thing I would say about your work is it's very, very positive. We're talking about, like, not being, like, you know, toxic positivity and stuff, like getting the ice bath and all that and listen to inspirational music. But it's very, very positive, your work, in terms of it saying at some level you're going to look at the basics of everything about you. And that's why your book's called How to Solve Any Problems in Your Life. And we're kind of touching on that now. But it really does give someone a chance to look at everything about their life. But it's also one of its big mantras is, or your work's big mantras is, to be kind and take responsibility. So you're saying to people, be kind to yourself, be kind to others, take responsibility. Let's really, really, really look at this and let's see how deep we can go and what we can reveal. Did you have any qualms about using that title for your book? Because I think you've actually achieved it. But did you have any qualms about that? How did you get past that using that title?
Well, it's dead interesting because that comes up a lot. Obviously, people will often say to me it's a bold claim.
Yeah.
And it came up because I was doing some traveling a couple of years ago before I'd written the book. And I just started, I'd been coaching people and these ideas and philosophies I was using. And I was living in a community house in Spain where the idea is everybody brings something to the group. So you share something that you do with the group. And every few days someone shares something and there's 20 people and you do a presentation. And they said to me, what can you do? And I said, well, I could talk about what I coach people on and, you know, how I've changed my life. And they said to me, what would you call the session? And they were the words that came out of my mouth. I just said out loud how to solve any problem in life. And when I said it, there was a room of about 15 people. Everyone stopped and looked at me and went, that's a bold claim. And I went, yeah. And then later on in the week, I did the presentation and everyone loved it. And I ended up doing it three times in the space of 2 weeks because people kept asking to see it again, or new people came and like, they were like, Paul, will you do your presentation again? Everyone really liked it. And it just made me realize, yeah, you know, if it's a bold claim, but I stand behind it. And it's because of what I found in my own life. And I've literally done this with anybody who comes to me with anything. And the problem we've got with this is, like, whenever I speak to marketers, I've done loads of marketing over my life in running different businesses and stuff. They all say the same thing. You need to be niche. You need to be more specific. You need to, you know, what problem is it specifically? And they hate it when you say, I can help anyone with anything.
Yeah.
Because that's not targeted enough for marketing. So it actually damages what I do from a marketing perspective. I'd be better off just focusing on one thing and saying, I can help you with that. But it's wider than that. So I'm not going to water it down. It all comes back to my realization that all of my problems in life came down to this one thing. And I don't care what it is. When people bring me things, I can show them how the real problem is that they don't feel good enough inside, that they have low self-worth. And loads of people don't even want to hear that. Like, they don't want to know that because our ego, our confidence. I was a very self-confident person. Even my own mum, when I first revealed this to friends and family, they were like, it's nonsense. It's nonsense that you've got low self-esteem. And I was like, why? And they said, you're the most confident person we know. And I was like, confidence and self-esteem are two completely different things. Confidence is an external thing. I'd created characters that were very confident in what I was doing. The problem was internally, like deep down, I didn't feel good enough. And when you've seen what I've seen now, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and I'm acutely aware of that. I talk about confirmation bias in the book. And everyone's life is riddled with us just proving to ourselves what we really think. So I do my best to challenge that all the time whilst acknowledging it's difficult. But the reality is, everyone I've ever coached with problems all across the board, depression, addictions, ADHD, anger problems, relationship problems, weight problems, we never talk about the problem. I give a story in the book, and it's a guy who, a former client who shared his story on my podcast, so you can hear his full interview when we talk about this. He came to me with addiction problems and said, I've seen a therapist. My relationship's in trouble. I might lose my kid, but I've looked at some of your stuff and I think you might be able to help. I was like, great, let's get into it. It was something like 6 to 8 weeks later. He came onto a call and said to me, do you know what, Paul? This is mad. I came onto this call thinking about what do I need to talk to you about. And I was thinking about work, like I want to talk to you about some stuff from work. And then he said, I realized I came to you 6 to 8 weeks ago with addiction problems. He went, I'm not even thinking about them now. And I said to him, well, that's really good. And he went, but it doesn't make any sense. And I went, why? And he said, we haven't talked about addiction once. And I said, I laughed and said, I know. I went, it's because it's got nothing to do with addiction. That's just the surface level. And the problem we have, and it's my issue with the likes of AA and stuff like that. And again, the same caveat, if it works for you, brilliant. But the problem with things like AA is they focus on the symptom. They focus, you literally sit in a group and tell yourself every week you're an alcoholic. Guess what? It's going to keep you as an alcoholic. You're counting the days since you last had a drink. Guess what? I heard Tony Robbins say this once again, credit him. The only reason you count the days since you last had a drink is so that next time you have a drink, you can tell people how long it's been since you had your last one. If you've give up drinking, you've give up drinking, but it's not about drinking. And this is, I see this a lot. Watch out for this for the listener. If you see someone, I see this a lot, right? Because we're in a time of quick fixes. People who are overweight fly to Turkey and get their stomach stapled, and then they come back and lose weight. And I go to people, and it gives me no pleasure to see this happen, and it happens every time. Watch what happens to their life. Because that problem will come out somewhere else because they haven't dealt with the root cause. All they've done is dealt with the symptom, which was they're eating too much food because they don't feel good enough. Well, guess what? If you physically stop yourself eating food now to stop that problem, you still don't feel good enough. So it's going to come out somewhere else. You're going to start drinking more. You're going to start taking drugs. You're going to start gambling. You're going to start having more relationship problems. Something else is going to happen in your life. Because you haven't dealt with the root issue. And what this stuff does is it gets right to the root and magically it takes away loads of things all at once. So someone might come to me with an addiction issue, and 6 months later they'll say to me, do you know what's really interesting, Paul? My relationship with my wife's got better. And I'll be like, yeah. Because guess what? The problems in your relationship were also caused by low self-worth. Your stuff in work that was going wrong, that was caused by low self-worth. You were drinking too much. The number of people, because I'm a big football fan, the number of people who say to me, I've completely changed my relationship with football. I'm like, why? Just not as angry about it anymore. Just not as invested in it anymore. Why? Because all of those things were caused by low self-worth. It's magic, and that's why I'm still confident saying it all comes down to the same thing. And the title How to Solve Any Problem in Life is right, because even I work with businesses and business owners and stuff. Bring me a business problem and I'll show you how it's not a business problem at all. It just comes down to low self-worth and how you don't feel good enough, because no matter what it is, it's just a symptom you're looking at.
Yeah, I think I wasn't happy with the way I was at work and in my working life. And by establishing who's on the mic, I've kind of dealt with my work issues. I've just said, right, who's on the mic here while you're approaching this problem? And just by that alone, work, I wouldn't say I've got work sussed completely, but I just feel better in my day-to-day work reality by knowing who's in charge and who's on the mic, who's in charge of the control deck at that particular time. And it's so powerful, this stuff. And as you say, you're looking at the root causes rather than the more superficial elements. One of the things I found very useful as well is the sliding scale 1 to 100, because we tend to have a very binary approach to like good day, bad day, but you advocate using the sliding scale to give more of a sense of perspective. Do you want to talk very briefly about that?
Yeah, it's a key. It's one of the many parts of this work that's key to it all coming together. And that is, we are raised in a world, and I could talk for hours on how I think it's done purposefully by the powers that be, but we're raised in a world that's very black and white. So everything is forced into boxes, no matter what it is. Like, just think about your life generally. In the UK, you're either a Labour or a Conservative voter, pretty much. In the US, it's Republican or Democrat. Red or blue, black or white, colour of our skin, black or white. It's all nonsense. What I've realised is, if we look at things, and instead of saying it's one or the other, look at things on a scale, no matter what it is. So on a scale of 0 to 100, with 100 being the top end of the scale and 0 being the bottom, it helps you to have a more nuanced approach to life. So, and by having that nuanced approach to life, you can be more, go back to your point about being kind and taking responsibility. You can be kinder to yourself and you can be kinder to other people, because the other thing about the black and white thinking is, Whenever we're split into categories, black or white, whenever we put that in ourselves or other people, I always talk about silent implications. The silent implications in things we do all the time, one of the silent implications is one of the sides is right and one of the sides is wrong. Or that one of the sides are the goodies and the other sides are the baddies. And guess what? Both sides think they're the goodies. No one ever thinks they're the baddies. I've got this thing about World War II where I think we, because of the way we're taught about it in school, it's like we think, without ever stopping to say this out loud, it's like we think that the Germans and the Nazis knew they were the baddies. Like, they were walking around going, no, we're the baddies. The others are the goodies. And I remember speaking to this guy once in Northern Cyprus, Turkish Cyprus. And he was telling me, he was a really interesting guy. He was, when he was a kid, the Taliban tried to recruit him and his uncle saved him and sent him away and got him educated. And I said to him, oh God, because think about the way we're taught about the Taliban. And I said to him, God, that must have been awful. So what was it? Like, was it like brainwashing? How did they do it? And he went, no. You know, Paul, they used to just come to the schools and give presentations. We wanted to join the Taliban. And I was like, how could you want to join the Taliban? And he said to me, because you're not the goodies. He said, you just think you're the goodies. He said, your bombs, he said, British and American and European bombs make orphans of people who then get recruited by the Taliban who want to fight against you because you killed their mum and dad. And I was like, it was a moment I'll never forget. And that must have been about 10 years ago. And I just remember going, oh yeah, we're raised to think we're the goodies in everything. And no matter what you are in your life, no matter what you do, you think you're the goodie. And most of the time, you're not. Because we're all goodies and we're all baddies. We're all victims, we're all villains. And the scaled approach to life, there's so many different examples you give, but the scaled approach is really important for that, because the main thing is it takes you away from that black and white thinking.
Yeah, I've found that really helpful. The other thing as well is, as well as talking about the past and sub-personalities, you encourage people to write about events in their life that have been traumatic and to kind of have a free flow in writing about them to kind of help you to deal with them, to deal with your emotions, and that you shouldn't suppress emotions, you should deal with them. But you also advocate like a day-to-day approach, and I've been doing the emotional journaling that you've been speaking about, where anything that's on your mind, you write about it, kind of get it out, if you like, try to deal with the emotion by allowing it to happen rather than, oh, I don't want to feel like that, so I'm gonna, you know, drink a bottle of cider or whatever. So you advocate the kind of experiencing of life and reflecting on life through that free flow and writing. Now, I've seen this advocated with like artists, you know, this idea of just free flow and writing, because it helps you to externalize things. And I found the emotional journaling really useful for that on a day-to-day basis. And Some days I think to myself, oh, I've had a good day today. That was good. And then when I have a bad day, I go, right, I'll write a little bit about that, you know, to get it out. I have found that really, really helpful. Is that something that you still do on a day-to-day basis or fairly regularly?
How often I do it depends on what's going on, to be honest. So, and it's something I'm still working on. Something I talk about a lot in this work is this is not me preaching from an ivory tower, which is something, again, I'm not sure it happens intentionally, but I think a lot of the high profile people in the personal development space, they can come across as the joke. They've got everything figured out and everything's great. And if you just do what they do, your life will be perfect. And one of the dangers with that is when you do the thing they tell you to do and then your life isn't perfect, you start thinking, well, hang on, I must be doing something wrong. And something I am happy to do and like to do with people is share that I still have problems as well. This is an ongoing thing. Something I talk about a lot in this work is what we're doing is we're like laptops that we've been programmed since we were little kids. Yeah. And the programming we've been having, by the time you'd get into the point in your life where you want to do something about this, most people are in their mid to late 30s at the earliest. I have coached some people in their 20s, and whenever I find someone in their 20s coming into this world, I'm like, oh, you're so good for you. Like, I wish I'd have done this in my 20s. But most people, it's mid to late 30s, 40s, 50s. By that point, we've been getting this programming for decades. So to change who we are and to change how we operate in the world is not a quick fix. It's undoing this decades of programming and replacing it with other stuff. And I've been doing this for 4 years now, intensively, like really intensively, and coaching other people. So I, you know, I'm talking about this stuff every day, but I'm still up against 38 years of the old programming. So my life is still evolving on a daily basis. And so to come back to the question, I used to write every day. Then it sort of evolved to basically writing when I needed to. So if something comes up and I feel like I need to write about it, then I'll write about it. Something I'm trying to do more and more now is stopping and writing when times are good as well. Mm. And this came from the actor Matthew McConaughey when he released his autobiography a couple of years ago. I remember hearing him talk about this. And he said he'd look back over his journals and he realized it was all bad times. Mm. Like, you write when things were bad. And he said, well, that isn't as beneficial to me as writing whenever I can, because what I've found is if you write when things are good as well, what you can do, I will often, I've literally got out my journals for the past couple of years, a few days ago, because every now and then I'll just go back and read through everything, because what it helps you to do is with fresh eyes and from like a bird's eye view, look at your own life, watch yourself, see the patterns, look for things. Something I realized, just before Christmas, I've given up drinking completely now, and I've been to and fro with that for a while. And I used to be a very big drinker, Joe, big part of my personality, big part of my lifestyle. And what I realized last time I read through my journals was you could spot a clear pattern that I'd be doing well. And then I'd go out on a big drinking session and I'd get depressed and things would go wrong. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, this is not a good thing. I've got a story in my life that this is a good thing. It's not. So reading back over the journals can be a really powerful thing to do. And that's why writing in good times as well as difficult times is powerful, because something you can do is look back and think, when you're in a down patch, what did I do last time? What was I doing in my life differently when things were good compared to now? And again, you start to see patterns in that as well. What are the things in my life that make me feel better? What are the things that make me feel worse? And you can just slowly over time evolve and get more of the good stuff in.
Yeah, I mean, it isn't something that necessarily gives you an instant satisfaction journal, and I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of people don't do it. But once you form that habit, I find that it is very, very helpful at laying issues down. As you say, I do a little gratitude thing as well, like things to be grateful for. But looking at things in your past as well that you don't really think about, that's helpful to write about them, because you like revisiting them and dealing with them, and then that helps you in the present as well. So I find that really useful. But just before we start tying things together, one of the big things I found useful in your work is conflict resolution, and you use the idea of vulnerability from Brené Brown. This idea that when there's a conflict, instead of letting the ego take over or a negative you get on the mic, that you stay quite calm and expose your vulnerability in order to deal with conflict. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that and why that approach is important? Because a lot of people might think, oh, that means that you're surrendering or letting someone walk all over you, and you can't be doing that. So what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, vulnerability is huge. And for anyone who hasn't heard of Brené Brown or listened or watched or read any of her stuff, just I'd highly recommend just go out and consume everything she's ever done. Loads of books, TED Talks, Netflix show, there's all kinds. She's got a podcast. But the key part of that is this, and this is a point especially, I mean, it does apply to everyone, but especially to for men from places like Liverpool. We have been raised to think that, you know, vulnerability is weak, being displaying certain emotions is weak, and resolving conflict is about aggression and violence sometimes. And I used to think, because I mean, I was a trained lawyer. I've chatted to my niece about this. Got a 16-year-old niece who loves winning arguments against people. And she said to me years ago, she went, "I can never win an argument against you."
Ha
And I laughed and said to her, "I've been trained by like the best law firms on the planet. I'm like a ninja. I can win an argument against you even if I know I'm wrong." That's what being a lawyer is half the time. And so I used to think that was the way forward. Like, but the way I talk about it is, it's going into battle in a suit of armor with a sword and shield. And I'm the bigger, and I've got the bigger sword and shield, and I've got the bigger suit of armor, and I'm harder than you, so I'm going to win. But the problem is, even the way I said that, then that comes down to winning and losing. And even a lot of people I work with and coach over time, when they talk about conflicts with other people, they talk about it in the sense of winning and losing. And I say to them now that what you've got to remember is, if you're in a situation with someone, whether it's someone you love or someone you work with, where there's a winner and a loser, you've both already lost. That's not going to be good for anybody. Like, your ego likes to win, it likes other people to lose. But in the long term, for your emotional well-being, for your peacefulness, to feel content in the world, beating other people into submission so that your ego can win, it's not good for you and it's not good for them. What vulnerability is basically us coming into the same situation and saying to the other person and going first. And this is the bit about it being vulnerable and difficult. You say to the other person, "I'm going to put down my sword and shield, and I'm going to take off my suit of armor, and I'm just going to stand here in my underpants, and I just want to talk." And you've got to be careful doing that. Like, don't do that literally, because you'll get arrested. But you know, metaphorically, what I found is, I've gone from thinking that being the biggest man in the biggest suit of armor with the biggest sword is the most powerful thing you can do in life, to completely changing my mind. The single biggest, most powerful thing I have ever seen and done in my life is be vulnerable. Because if you go into a fight with a sword and shield, you are gonna come up against other people who think they're harder than you, and some of them will be. Some of them will have a bigger sword, some of them will be bigger fighters. If you go into a situation and you show complete vulnerability, and you can just be you, and you can just be open and honest with someone, and you can tell them that you're going into a conversation about something that's a conflict, and saying to them, "Look, I'll be completely honest with you. I'm actually quite scared coming into this conversation, and I'm worried about what you think of me. I'm worried about what the reaction is going to be, and I'm worried about what the fallout is going to be. And what I'd like to do is just see if we can both get to a place with this where we both win, and everything comes out, and we both feel better afterwards. I think that'd be better for everybody." I have never once gone into a conversation like that and not come out with a good result. Because my therapist said this to me, the first therapist I've worked with who I loved when I first started, he said egos need other egos to fight against. He said, so that's why we end up in these big fights and conflicts and arguments. He said, but if you drop your ego, if you go into vulnerability, the other ego's got nothing to fight against. And when an ego's got nothing to fight against, it drops itself. It can't help it. It can't sustain itself. The problem is, it takes a lot of courage to do that. And it takes skill, because this is something we haven't been taught to do. So when we first start doing it, we're going to be a bit clumsy. We're going to be a bit messy with it. We're going to make mistakes. And that's where doubling down on the vulnerability is the most important thing again. Because when we get afraid, we want to pick up our sword and shield again. And we want to just go straight back to fighting and going, "Oh, forget that. I'm going to fight you instead." But if we make a mistake when we're trying to be vulnerable, and we say to people, "Sorry, I've just made a mistake. I'm trying this out. This is a new thing for me. This is a new way I'm trying to live my life. Please bear with me. Please be patient with me as I say this." We're talking. What we end up doing, go full circle back to what I talked about before. If you think there's the real version of us, which is the little kid, and then you've got all these characters. As soon as we go into vulnerability, the little kid inside us is talking to the little kid inside the other person. And that little kid and the other person just wants a hug as well. And that's why it's so powerful.
I think one of the good things you say in your work is the idea that everyone's basically like a 4-year-old emotionally inside. And when you're talking to someone, you just need to be mindful that you're effectively 2 4-year-olds talking to yourself, but it's up to each other. But it's good to know that you are a 4-year-old while you're doing it. But I've used there's three strategies you talk about in your work about setting up boundaries and admitting to vulnerability. You use two particular strategies. They're the three I've picked up, and I've used them. I even messaged you once after I'd used one, and you and said I just tried this and it was amazing, and you were laughing like messaging me back about it. But it works, and it means that the old ego coming up against another ego isn't fed, and it is hard and it is tricky, and some days you will be tired and you will make mistakes. But ultimately, it's the only way to live your life. You know, it's the only way to live if you want to live a better life. And you know, it might sound counterintuitive, but using vulnerability in conflict and to resolve conflict and also to set boundaries, which is another big part of your work, I found that so helpful. Which isn't to say, and this is something I've talked about in other podcasts, it doesn't mean that you bend over. As you say, you explain your boundary and then you defend your boundary and say, this is a boundary for these reasons. And you make it very clear to the other person. So it's not about like being submissive. It's about being intelligent and wise in how you approach relations. So I found that really, really helpful. So Paul, where can people find out about you? We can put details of your book and your website. You've got lots of stuff there. You do counseling and coaching for people, don't you? And you do help for businesses, help for individuals. And I think there's details about your course on your website as well, your online course. Is that right?
Yeah, so since I started doing this, the whole point was to get it out to as many people as possible and make it accessible to as many people as possible. So over the years, I've developed a whole range of things now. So basically, if you go to my website, paul7cope.com, you can sign up for my mailing list, which just gives you free stuff. So if you've got no money and you don't want to invest anything in this, or you've just heard about it and you're just curious and you want to know more, go to the free stuff. There's podcasts, there's YouTube channels, there's emails I send out each week, discounts on things. So there's free. You can get free chapters of the book as well. So you can read the first four chapters of the book without buying it, see what you think of it. Then if you want to go further, there's the book and the audio book, which are, 10, 15 quid, whatever they are, which is the full, it's everything from start to finish, as you've seen, but it's in a book. The next step up from that is I've created an online course, which what you said earlier, I basically realized that I could take 6 months worth of coaching and turn that into a 3-day event. So I coached people solidly for 3 days, which is, so it's a, there's a, it's about 30 hours of stuff on that course, excuse me now, which you can do in as long as you want. So the way you've done it, perfect. You'll take months to do it and work through it. If you want to put a few days aside and smash it, you can. But the reality is, this stuff is stuff to revisit all the time anyway. So you want to come back to it. I still go over it all the time. Except something that dawned on me a few months ago is that my book is basically all the stuff I learned from years and years of doing this. So whenever I want to recap on the stuff I've learned, going over my own book is a good way of doing it, because that's all it is. It's just a recap of everything I've seen from other places. And then for people who want to invest the most amount of money, I'm starting online coaching programs. So it'll be a group that'll take through the work over the space of a few months. And then there's one-on-one coaching, which is the most expensive part, but that's beyond a lot of people's price range, because I can only coach a few people at a time. It's very time and energetically demanding, so that's more expensive. But that gives you the whole range of things that you can use then, if you like this stuff, to get stuck into and to change things.
Well, I can't recommend it more highly enough, particularly your book and your online course as a way for people to get into it. And you know, the book's £10. There's exercises. I think it was about that price. There's exercises throughout it. And I know that Ian, me and Ian spoke on a recent podcast about the importance of your work in both our lives from Hope Street as well. You've also helped Stephen Warnock, haven't you? The ex-Liverpool player. And he came to you and has done coaching. And I saw a talk with you and him at St. Bede's in Ormskirk. I think it was last year. You've worked with a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds, and I just can't emphasize how much it's helped me and how it can help absolutely anyone. So thanks very much, Paul, for your time. Have you got a few more minutes? Just, I was just going to ask you about one other thing, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
We're just over an hour. It was just about the health stuff. I've got depression. I take antidepressants. I've got Behçet's disease, which is a similar condition to psoriasis. And what's the other condition? You've got AS.
Ankylosing spondylitis.
That's correct, yeah. So I've got a similar condition to that, and I've been really interested in what you said about how by working on yourself and removing the trauma from you as a person, it's actually yielded health benefits for you as well, and that you've made some intelligent choices like giving up alcohol. I don't drink anymore, which you say have made you feel so much better. And you've actually come off some quite strong medication, which you were expected to be on long term. And this is something I'm very interested in. It might be something that I come back and maybe revisit with you again in the future about that little journey, because I've been on very, very high medication since 2007. And although I'm better now than I was, I'm still taking some, you know, quite serious stuff. But that journey you explained in your book, where you said by working on yourself, they were physical. Now, we know that the mind and the body, very tightly linked, and the idea of holism and a lot of the stuff we've looked at means that by working on one, you are basically working on the other. But I'm scared to take those steps, and I know that you tell us a great tale in the book where, like, you're lying on the floor with your dog and you can't get up because your back's hurting so much, you've come off the medication, and then you just start laughing at the situation. How long did that kind of process take for you to get through it, that kind of transition from worrying about whether post-medication life was possible to actually living post-medication life, if you know what I mean?
The immediate answer that comes up is it's still ongoing. Yeah. It's not something that disappears. I still have, pain issues linked to what the Western medical world called ankylosing spondylitis, but I don't call it that anymore. And it's only because, going back to what we were saying before, so the three chronic things I was dealing with were psoriasis, Crohn's disease, and spondylitis. And I have healed fully psoriasis and Crohn's disease. Now, if you speak to any doctor in the Western medical world, easy for me to say, they'll tell you that there is no cause of those things and there is no cure. So the only thing they can do is give you medication for the rest of your life. And again, going back to that, Joe, when we started the conversation, what was it like as a kid? That was the worst thing anyone could say to me. I was like, so I just take these drugs for the rest of my life with all these mad side effects that actually you can't even tell me what the side effects are for some of them because they're new drugs. And they're like, yeah. And they would say it like, yeah, but it makes you feel a little bit better, doesn't it? And I'm like, well, a little bit better, but that what's actually causing it? For me, it was no different to going to the doctors with a sore knee and them saying to me, we'll give you painkillers. And even as a teenager, I used to say to the doctors, I don't want painkillers. I want to know what's wrong with my knee. Like, if you just give me painkillers and I've got a bad knee and I can't feel the pain anymore, I'm going to make my knee worse, aren't I? I'm going to, like, logically. And loads of this stuff ties into me, my work as a lawyer and I talk about the old me and the new me. The old me's completely different to the new me. But loads of this stuff, people get lost because it becomes woo-woo and, it's just a bit out there. And I talk people through and go, no, we can stick to logic and this makes perfect sense. Like, if a doctor can't tell you what's wrong with your knee, but they'll give you painkillers, and then you keep exercising on your knee, or your knee's going to get worse, isn't it? Because you don't know what's wrong with it. And if I tell you that I know people who have fixed their knee, wouldn't you rather know how they fixed their knee and go to them instead of the man in the white coat who's just giving you painkillers? And that's where I got to with all this stuff, which was I just had such a strong belief. And this does come down to belief systems, I think, and your belief in the world you live in and what you want to do. One of my mates said it to me a while ago. He was like, he said, the way you talk about the world sounds a lot like faith. And I said, it is. And that is a big part of whatever it is in life. You know, if you want to change your life, believing that it is possible is the first thing you have to do. And the number of times in the past few years since I came off medication, that if you'd have spoken to my family, they'd have said to you, we desperately want him to go back on his medication because my pain, my symptoms were worse than they were before. And I just said to them, I will not go back on the medication because I believe that what I am doing will fundamentally change things, and I'm prepared for this to be things get worse before they get better, which is often the case with long-term fixes for things. Even in this joke, in this work, emotionally and psychologically, there are times when your life gets worse before it gets better, and having that belief that it's gonna get better helps you drag through. Otherwise, you just keep getting dragged back to the old life. And I think the thing that kept me through on both sides, the health and the sort of emotional, psychological side, was knowing how bad it was in the past. I'd already been in my own life, I'd already been depressed and suicidal, living the way I used to live. So whenever there's that draw to go back to that lifestyle, I think, well, what's the point? I already know what's down that road. At least this road has got hope that things get better. And it's the same with the medication. I know there's no, if I go back to the medication in the Western world medical system, I know there's no cure. They tell them themselves. I'll sit in front of a doctor and they'll tell me there's no cure. Well, I know people who have cured 100% from all of these things. And it's not make-believe. Like, they've literally done it. That's where this comes from. So I just believe that, when we've had decades of our systems being programmed in a certain way, to undo that stuff just takes a bit of time. And psoriasis, I know my body really well now, so I can see when I suppress emotions and something will flare up, or and it's just like a little barometer for me now that helps me move forward. And so I'll give you a piece of advice if you want it to wrap up, is the first thing I'd do if you're interested in making that next step and so coming away from medication and going further down this path, is I would start by stop using the labels that the Western medical world has given you that keeps you locked in it. So if you go back to when you just, as you described it to me, you said you have depression. So even just gently changing that to, I sometimes feel depressed, is completely different. Because having depression or being depressed are states of being. It's who I am. That's what I used to be. Oh, I'm depressed. I am depressed. And if we challenge that and go, no, I'm not depressed all the time. I sometimes feel depressed. And then we add on to the end of that, and that's okay. Like, I still sometimes feel depressed, and I've been doing this work for 4 years. But guess what? I don't feel like it's a bad thing to feel depressed anymore. If I feel depressed now, all I do is go, ah, what's my system trying to tell me? Because depression to me is my system trying to tell me I need to take a break. Something's not right. I'm doing too many things I don't like doing. So it's like a warning flag. It's an alarm bell. And I'll go to myself, okay, maybe I just need a day in bed. Maybe it's just time to take a break, to relax, to recharge, to write down, to talk to someone, all of these different things. And it's the same with other health stuff. This we could talk about that for hours. It's a whole separate side. But it's not a quick fix. And that's something about this work, which I'm very upfront with people about, is you can learn it quickly, but it's not a quick fix. This is gently and slowly changing who you are and how you operate in the world. No different to, there's a, there are people out there who will tell you if you want to lose weight that you can do it in 2 weeks. And there are people out there who are telling the truth, who are more healthy, and say, if you want to lose weight, you need to change your lifestyle. You need to change the way you think about food. You need to change the way you think about yourself as a person. That's a long-term thing. And what I'd encourage anybody listening to get away from in any aspect of their life that they want to change is the idea that it will change quickly and it will stick. As soon as we accept that we're always a student, which is a big part of this work, like, I'm always going to be learning this stuff for the rest of my life, it just makes it so much easier because it takes the pressure off. I don't need to figure this all out in 10 minutes. I don't need to have done it all this year. I've got the rest of my life to slowly figure it out and to slowly make changes. And if I've made a change in a year from now, that's great. If I make a change in 2 years from now, that's great. We're slowly progressing in the right direction, and that's the most important thing.
When my health problem started, it kind of came at a time when I was really stressed and I was overworked and not sleeping enough. And I've made a lot of changes since then that aren't in the textbook, as it were, that might be like I've started doing regular acupuncture, meditation, I changed my diet for healthier stuff, etc. And I do feel a lot better. But that Western approach, it is very, very limiting. And the benefits of science, yeah, we haven't got smallpox anymore. We're not going down that rabbit hole today. But there are other perspectives out there which we often overlook. I think people need to take responsibility and get interested and be kind with their physical health as well as their mental health, and they do interlock. And I think that's a very important breakthrough to acknowledge that. And I certainly feel that when I was on high-dose steroids for years, and I come off them, I thought, oh, this isn't going to last. And anyway, I stuck with it. It wasn't very nice for a bit, but I got through it, and things started to stabilise. So there's definitely holistic approaches to things which we don't always hear about in terms of physical health as well as mental health. Paul, thank you very much for your time. It's been a real pleasure. Sorry for going over a little bit there, but I've really enjoyed it. I think our listeners will really enjoy it as well. I just want everyone to check out Paul Cope's work. It is fantastic. You know, I teach in schools. I know that you were interested in maybe looking at doing some work in schools. Have you had any interest, or have you thought about how that might happen moving forward? Is it something that you've looked at in any detail, or...?
It's not something I've looked at in any detail, but a couple of people have mentioned it to me, and I'd be more than happy to explore it. Definitely. Yeah. This stuff, everyone who learns this stuff says the same thing, which is, I can't believe it's not taught in schools.
Yeah.
And I can go down more rabbit holes as to exactly why I think it's not. But for me, you teach kids this, it will transform their lives. Yeah. I'm in a new relationship now, and fortunate to have two little beautiful step boys in my life, and stepchildren who are little boys, 2 and 3 and 4 years old. And doing this work with 3 and 4 year olds, when I first started dating my partner over a year ago, she said to me, they're too young to learn this stuff. And I went, how old do you think we were when we started learning the bad stuff? We were all soaking this up, all this negative programming we've been getting, we've all been soaking up since we were that age. So actually, they do get it, and you can talk to them gently about this stuff, even telling kids that all their emotions are valid, and when they're upset, it's okay to be upset. It transforms their lives. You can see it in them. You can see the changes in their personality. You see the changes in their behavior. You see them become more confident. You can see them, their behavior patterns already going in a trending in a more positive direction. So yeah, I'd love to talk to schools about this.
Yeah, my 3 year son's kind of getting it at the moment as well. So,
thank you for having me on, it for all the lovely stuff you've said. And I say this to everyone I work with who's got kids: the greatest gift you can give to your kids is to do this work, not to do it on them, to do it on you, because you do this work and you become the greatest parent they could have ever had in their life. I've seen it with people I've coached, and they've gone from, Joe, a classic struggling with a child, classic relationship that we've all experienced with parents, and everybody who's got kids has experienced, to just this unbelievable relationship that they connect on a completely different level, and their child or children thrive because they've got a parent all of a sudden who can connect with them emotionally and can talk on an emotional level with them. It's the greatest gift you could give them.
Right, Paul, thanks very much for your time, mate, for going through what your philosophy and way of life is in a bit more detail, and also to bring it to new people. So thanks very much, mate.
My pleasure, mate.